So now, having done some of that practice, we have some idea of what this Satipatthana is about. Notice what just happened when we were using our mind in that way, that particular way of developing this art of attention. We started out with just our ordinary consciousness, yeah? Sight, sound, smell, taste, touches, our mind out there in the world, yeah? So you notice that as soon as those senses are open, as soon as we're paying attention to them, they tend to draw our mind out to them, yeah? So we can see that very obviously with sights, you know, as soon as we see a sight that we're interested in, our attention goes out to that, yeah? We see something that's very attractive, our mind goes out to that, we want to look at it. If it's a person, we find them very attractive, we want to look at them. A sight we find very beautiful, we have to look at that. Or something that's very repulsive, yeah? Sometimes we see something that's very ugly, like say we see a mutilated body or something like that, it's very ugly. We can't look at it, we want to turn our eyes away, yeah? So you can see how our mind is getting involved in those sights, yeah? It's not like a camera. Yeah, you get a camera, you point it wherever you... If the eye was like a camera, you point it anywhere. The camera doesn't care. Doesn't care what it, if it's photographing the most beautiful photograph or the most revolting thing. The camera doesn't mind. But our eyes do, yeah? And that's because we have that involvement in that attachment to what we're seeing. So then when we come, we sit down to meditate. We get our body set. We're in a peaceful place. We establish the mindfulness in that very special way. We are, in effect, we're like choosing what we're going to pay attention to. We're directing our mind here. This is what I want to look at. Not forcing the mind, okay? So you're not shackling it up in chains, dragging it and whacking it over the head and saying, look at this, yeah? But you're just suggesting to the mind, focusing, looking at that very gently. Now, as we chose in this meditation, we chose to use the breath as our object, okay? So we can identify these two aspects of the meditation, can't we? One is the subjective side of meditation, that is, what are we doing with our minds? How are we applying our mindfulness? And the other one is the objective side. It's like what we're applying our mindfulness to, yeah? What is the object of meditation? So in this case, the object we've chosen is the breath. And we've chosen that object because it has certain qualities that are useful for this meditation, okay? That is to say, it has qualities which are like the qualities of the mind that we want to develop through the meditation. For example, the breath is peaceful, yeah? So we want to develop a peaceful mind, so we watch the breath. It's something peaceful, yeah? The breath is smooth, so we want to develop a smooth mind, so we watch the breath. The breath is soft, so we want to develop a soft mind, so we watch the breath. Yeah? We're putting the mind in an environment that will bring about these kinds of conditions. Just like if you want to, you know, go for a walk on the beach or a walk in the park, yeah? Walk in a peaceful place. When you're in that peaceful place, your mind will feel peaceful because it's in that peaceful environment. Yeah? So this is exactly what we're doing here. We're choosing that very special environment, like a garden for the mind. Yeah? A very peaceful garden for the mind, and that mind can open up inside there. One of the things that's happening in that process is that this diversity that we're seeing, sight, sound, smell, taste, touches, is all disappearing. Yeah? Now, actually, it feels almost the opposite, doesn't it? Sometimes it feels when you come to meditate that, oh, your mind's just all over the place. That, you know, you just hear all these sounds and you've got all these feelings in your body and you've got these thoughts and things and you feel like your mind is very fractured and diverse. Well, of course it is, yeah, because it's not peaceful yet. But what's important at that stage is the mere fact that you know that it's distracted. Yeah? Previously, before you meditated, of course you were distracted, but you didn't even know it. Yeah? So that's like you're completely lost. Yeah, you're lost and you don't know that you're lost. Okay? When you come and sit down to meditate, you're still lost, but at least you know that you're lost. Yeah? So you can start to find your way. You need to have something still in order to assess what motion is. Yeah. And this is, of course, one of the great insights of Einstein about the relativity of motion. Motion, there's no kind of absolute starting and stopping, but motion is always relative to where the observer is. So if the observer is always moving around, yeah, how can you see whether something's still or moving? It's as if you've got a camera and you're continually moving the camera all over the place, a video camera. How can you ever focus on anything? How can you know? Is that thing still or is it moving? You can only know that when you hold the camera still. Yeah, you focus the camera still and steady for a long period of time, then you can get to know something. So the Buddha has said that this Satipatthana, one of the most famous phrases that he used about Satipatthana was that Satipatthana is the Ekayana Magga. And this is a phrase which, like so many things in the suttas and in Buddhism, on the one hand is very simple, and yet its very simplicity causes it to become very, very controversial. So it's quite amazing, astounding, how this one little phrase could have sparked off so many discussions and very heated arguments about what it means. Yeah, crazy. The simple meaning of the phrase is very clear. It's not as if it's misunderstood. It's the eka means one, ayana means going, and magga means path. Okay, one going path. That's the literal meaning. But what does it actually mean in the context? What is it supposed to mean? And as Dr. Uma mentioned beforehand, that very often they claim this means it's the one and only way. Yeah. So Satipatthana is the one and only way, and that becomes like a piece of propaganda. Yeah, it's not a description of Satipatthana. It becomes like a club to hit people over the head with. Yeah, it's not actually telling you anything about this practice. Yeah, and it doesn't mean that. There's no real justification for thinking that Ekayana Magga means the one and only way. One of the reasons I think why the Buddhist traditions have lost the meaning of this is because it's not actually a Buddhist word. Okay. Now, if we look in the Pali tradition, Pali commentaries, they'll give us four or five different explanations for what this word means. Okay, which just tells us that they didn't actually really know. Yeah, so everyone had their own different opinion and they couldn't really decide. If you look in the Chinese translations, also there's many different translations of this term. I'll just try. I won't try to say them in Mandarin because it'd be a bit embarrassing. But like one of them is translated the one entrance way, or the one vehicle way. Because there's actually another phrase in Mahayana. They talk about the Ekayana, one vehicle. Yeah, it's in the Lotus Sutra. And so I guess the translators maybe were more familiar with that term, so they used Ekayana, but it's actually a different word in Pali or Sanskrit. And so on. So there's all these different renderings of it, and it tells us that actually 400 or 500 years after the Buddha, they didn't really know what this word meant anymore. And as I said, the reason why that's so is because it's not actually a Buddhist word. The reason why I think it's not a Buddhist word is because when the term appears most commonly in the suttas, okay, most of the time it's put into the mouth of Brahma, okay, or in the context where Brahma appears. So Brahma, the Buddha says, this is the one-way path, the Ekayana Magga. Brahma hears him, comes down and says, yes, you're right, this is the one-way path, and then he gives some verses in praise of the one-way path. Now this is a fairly standard kind of setting that we get in the suttas quite often, yeah, where the Buddha, especially in that period just after he's enlightened, and Brahma kind of reads his mind and comes down and says, yes, what you're saying is right, and he confirms it. Now, of course, whether that literally happened or not, I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so we can't say whether that's historical fact or not. But what it meant within the context, you know, quite clearly, is it's meant to authorize those teachings, yeah, within a Brahmanical culture. Yeah, in other words, they're saying that even our God, Brahma, likes this practice and praises it and supports it. Yeah, the purpose that it's serving within that culture. So that's from the Buddhist side. If we look then at the Brahmanical scriptures, you find that the phrase ekayana is in fact used in the Brahmanical scriptures as well. Not merely that it's used, you know, it's not merely that we find it scattered here or there in some obscure reference. It's actually the key term, very central term, in the most important of all of the meditative texts of the Brahmanical scriptures. Okay? Right there in the very center, the very heart of the most famous and important, and that's in a scripture called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Now, you probably haven't heard of that, because I guess most of you are not familiar with Brahmanical and Hindu scriptures, but this is the earliest and most important of what we call the Upanishads, and the Upanishads are the very important body of spiritual literature in the Brahmanical tradition. Now, within the Upanishads, this is by far the most important. And within the Brihadaranyaka, the most important sage, the most important teacher in that tradition, is a fellow called Yajnavalkya. And he was a great meditator, philosopher, sage, who lived probably not long before the Buddha, probably a couple of hundred years before the Buddha. And he, in fact, used to very commonly have dialogues with a king called Janaka. And Janaka was a historical king who's also mentioned quite a few times in the Jataka stories. So he's also mentioned in the Buddhist stories. And even today in India, there's a city called Janakpur, the city of Janaka. Yeah? So he was a historical character who really lived in India probably a couple of hundred years before the Buddha. Now, Yajnavalkya was in many ways a revolutionary figure. And he introduced a lot of very, very important innovations into the Brahmanical tradition. The key, like the pivotal dialogue involving Yajnavalkya is a particular dialogue with Yajnavalkya and his wife, Maitreyi. And it's a very, very beautiful dialogue, even though it's wrong view, okay, fair enough, it's not teaching, you know, it's not teaching Buddhist ideas, but it's very beautiful and very moving. A piece of spiritual literature. Yajnavalkya says he wants to go forth. Yeah, he announces to his wife, "I want to go forth, and now I want to make a settlement." He had two wives, so he said, "I want to make a settlement with my two wives." And now, even that's significant because the Brahmanical tradition wasn't a renunciate tradition like Buddhism. Yeah, that was a much later development. So even here, we're seeing a slight Buddhist similarity. He makes this proposal to his wife. "Now I want to go forth." And his wife, Maitreyi, said to him, "Venerable sir, even if you were to give me all the wealth in the whole world, would that free me from the clutches of death?" And he says, "No." She says, "Please teach me what you know so that I can escape from death." Yeah? Again, sounds very Buddhist, doesn't it? Yeah? So then Yajnavalkya starts to teach his wife. Now, this dialogue between the two of them is echoed in a particular sutta found also in the Buddhist scriptures in Sagatawaga, with a dialogue between King Pasenadi and his wife Mallika. It's clearly some kind of influence of one kind or another. Either one was copied from the other. It's not sure which one's copied from which. But Yajnavalkya says, it's not for the sake of the husband that the husband is dear, but for the sake of the self that the husband is dear. Okay, so this is this Brahmanical idea of the highest self. It's not for the sake of the wife that the wife is dear, it's for the sake of the self that the wife is dear. It's not for the sake of the children that the children are dear, but for the sake of the self that the children are dear. And so on and so on. Now this dialogue kind of builds up and builds up and builds up. I can't go through all of it, but I can simply comment that almost every phrase, every image, every idea has some kind of counterpart within the Buddhist suttas. It's very, very closely connected to the Buddhist suttas. Not necessarily saying it's teaching exactly the same doctrine, obviously it's not. But in terms of the spiritual environment, the language, the context is very, very close. Now as this passage builds up, the second last passage before the final revelation of Yajnavalkya's teaching, the second last passage, he says something like, just as the ocean is the convergence point of all the waters. Yeah? And this word that he's using for a convergence point is ekayana, the same word we find in the Satipatthana Sutta. Just as the ocean is the convergence point of all the waters, just as the eye is the convergence point of all sights, just as the ear is the convergence point of all sounds, yeah? And just as the nose is the convergence point of all smells. And again and again and again, he keeps repeating this imagery over and over and over again. And there's always this imagery of that returning to the one. Yeah, that one thing, there's a diversity, all those sights out in the world, but they all come together in the eye. All those sounds out in the world, but they all come together in the ear. It's that place of oneness where everything comes together. Yeah, and this is repeated over and over again, maybe 15 or 20 times in that phrase. And then finally, he reveals like the highest truth within that tradition, and that is that this self, what he calls this highest self, is nothing more than a vijnana ghanameva, nothing more than a sheer mass of consciousness. Yeah. So this is this very, very refined, very subtle teaching that we find in the Upanishads, that all of this diversity of the world is nothing more than an emanation from this one brilliant mass of consciousness. Okay, and that is what the highest self is. So this is that teaching in the Upanishads, which was a revolutionary doctrine and is the key teaching of this great sage Yajnavalkya. And the key term, the most important term in that whole dialogue is ekayana, the place where everything comes into oneness. Yeah. So I think it's very, very likely that when the Buddha was using the word ekayana, he was using it in a similar sense, and that's why it was put into the mouth of Brahma. It's Brahma speaking. Yeah? This is ekayana. The difference, of course, is that for the Brahmanical tradition, that's the highest goal. Yeah? The ekayana, that state of unification, was the highest goal. For Buddhism, of course, it's not the highest goal. It's just a factor on the path. It's a stage of spiritual development. Yeah? It's not the final goal, but it's part of the path. So this is what I think ekayana means in Buddhism. Now, the word eka, one, in meditation context in Buddhism, one always, without any exceptions, always refers to unification of mind, that is samadhi. Yeah? The Buddha said the samadhi is defined as one-pointedness of mind, citta se kagata. One-pointedness of mind is samadhi. So, I believe that this phrase, ekayana magga, means that this satipatthana is the way of practice that we use to lead to unification of mind, that is to lead to samadhi or jhana. And that is that same experience of that sheer mass of consciousness that Yajnavalkya was talking about. Subjectively, that's what it feels like. It feels like a return from all the diversity of the stuff in the world coming to that one unification. Yeah? Now, of course, the difference is that we don't say that's the self. Yeah, so fair enough. In that sense, it's quite different, and very obviously so. Yajnavalkya is very much emphasizing this is the self, this is the self, this is the self. And Buddha's saying this is not the self, this is not the self, this is not the self. Yeah, so there's a very clear difference there. Yeah, but the actual experience is the same. So that's what I think Satipatthana is about. I think that's the main meaning, the main emphasis of Satipatthana. How do you use your mind? How do you establish and focus your awareness that's going to lead you away from this diversity of the world and towards this oneness, this unification? Now we can see how that works. And now in the context of breath meditation, we were just practicing a few minutes ago. All of that stuff that's going on in the world, we leave that aside, we're not interested in it, we focus our attention just on that one thing, on that breath. Breath coming in, breath going out. Even within the 5 or 10 minutes of meditation we did earlier, I hope that you had kind of at least a little bit of experience of what it was like to actually bring your attention inwards, to focus your attention on something peaceful, and to see that peacefulness comes from a unification, from a letting go of all of the diversity in the world. Of course, not a complete letting go. We just did a little bit of meditation, still very shallow, but the first hints of moving in that direction and of what that might mean. So when we look at the teachings on Satipatthana that are found in the Buddhist scriptures, we find that this kind of theme is repeated quite a lot. That the idea that, you know, the skillful, for example, there's one simile called the cook. And in the Satipatthana Samyutta, this is found, there's a Pali version of this sutta, also a Chinese version. And they say that if you're just like a cook who's got to prepare meals for their master, yeah, but if they don't pay attention to their master's character and what their master likes and dislikes, and they prepare food which their master doesn't like, yeah, and their master's unhappy with them and doesn't pay them, right? So in the same way, like a monk who's meditating, who's not skillful, who doesn't understand the character of his own mind, yeah, just like the cook didn't understand the character of the master, the meditator doesn't understand the character of their own mind, they don't, as it were, feed their mind with the right kinds of food, yeah, they don't pay attention the right way, so then their mind does not reach samadhi, their mind does not reach one-pointedness, yeah. And that's a foolish, unskilled monk. Yeah? And so just like the skillful cook, yeah, will understand what their master likes, what they don't like. They will cook the kind of food that their master likes. Their master will be happy with them, give them a reward. Yeah, they'll be well paid and well looked after. The same way the skillful monk, when they're meditating, they understand the character of their mind. When they understand the character of their mind, they approach their meditation in the right way, and they, as it were, feed their mind with the right kind of food. So that food of the mind is your meditation object. Yeah? That's the food of the mind. That's the thing that the mind is sustained on. So a skillful meditator knows how to apply their mind onto that meditation object in order to make their mind unified, bring their mind to samadhi, to one-pointedness of mind. So if we look at the Satipatthana Sutta, you can see that there are many different ways of doing this. Okay? Now the breath meditation we've just taught is the most common one. Also in the suttas is very common and is quite, it's like distinguished, it's like picked out, and they say, yeah, this is actually the most powerful method of meditation. But there are also many others which are found as well. For example, some of the ones that are very commonly found is like the 31 parts of the body. So they start with head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin. So you start to investigate these. You can do that discursively by like thinking about what these things are. But ultimately you can also do it by focusing very precisely on an image of what these parts of the body are. And they help you to let go, to turn away from attachment to your body. Another one is the four elements meditation, where you investigate like the qualities of solidity, fluidity, the water element, the energy, the heat element, and the movement, the air element within your body. So you investigate these. So these are all part of that first Satipatthana, which is mindfulness of the body, establishment of mindfulness on the body. Now one of the things about Satipatthana is that almost always, when people talk about Satipatthana, and when people say Satipatthana is this and Satipatthana is that, that's almost always based on one particular sutta. That particular sutta is called the, quote-unquote, Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah? And that Satipatthana Sutta is found in two versions, in Pali, one in the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima 10, and also in the Digha Nikaya, Digha 22. Although in recent years, the Majjhima Nikaya version has been deleted from the Pali canon. The Pali Canon has been changed within the last 100-150 years, and now the Majjhima Nikaya version doesn't exist anymore in the Burmese version. They've cut it out and replaced it with the Digha Nikaya version. Yeah? So there's only one version, whereas in fact there should be two different versions. And that's a very substantial editorial change which the Burmese have seen fit to make to the Pali Canon within the last, it must have happened I think in the 19th century, mid-19th century, although I haven't exactly found out when that happened. So we like to think that, you know, the scriptures have been unchanged since the time of the Buddha, yeah? But they're still changing them, yeah? Even that recently. This is not just a minor change. This is like, I think about 10 pages worth of material has been added to the Majjhima Nikaya version. Yeah, that's a very significant development. And yet, for some reason, Buddhists don't even seem to know about this, that their own texts. I think it's outrageous. I sent an email to the people who published the Pali Tripitaka. They call the Vipassana Research Institute, and I said, "Listen, you know, you're tampering with the Pali Canon. You should change it back." I didn't get any response from them. So it's important. That's a very important to notice that. Yeah, Pali Canon has been changed, and specifically the Satipatthana Sutta has been changed even in recent times. Now, if we look at beyond this kind of the Satipatthana Sutta, actually there's stacks more Satipatthana Suttas. There's a whole collection of them in the Samyutta Nikaya, about 74 suttas dealing with Satipatthana, yeah, in the Samyutta Nikaya. And almost always they get ignored because everyone thinks that there's the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the first and last word on Satipatthana. And also when we look in the Chinese sources, there's plenty more materials. There's a whole other collection, 50 or so discourses, and the versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, there's about 7 or so different versions of that found in Chinese and other versions. Sometimes found in the suttas, sometimes found in Abhidhammas, and even in the Prajnaparamita Sutta. If anyone's familiar with Mahayana, you have a look at the Prajnaparamita Sutta, and one of the chapters of that actually has a whole version of the Satipatthana Sutta, almost identical with the Theravadin version, the version in the Pali Canon. And it's been like cut and pasted right in, except the only major difference is, it's just cut and paste, but they said instead of saying here a bhikkhu is mindful when walking in and walking out, it says here a bodhisattva is mindful when walking in and walking out. That's the only change, really. So it's very, very widely spread. Now, when we look at all those different versions, you realize that pretty much they're similar, yeah? They're talking about the same kinds of things, yeah? They were all talking about breath meditation, they're all talking about meditation for a start, they're all talking about it in a similar way, the breath, watching the breath, or the parts of the body, the elements, and so on. So all the main things are very similar in all of the versions, and yet the details are quite different. Okay, so for example, the specific details of what meditations are included will differ from one version to the other. For example, the shortest version is found in the Pali Abhidhamma, and that only has one meditation under body contemplation, which is the contemplation of the 31 parts of the body. It's the only one. The other ones are not mentioned. Sometimes another version might have 2, another version might have 3, another version might have 5 or 6 or 7 or even more different meditations listed under that first contemplation of the body. So the details are quite different. So this, of course, raises questions like, what's going on? Yeah? Why are there all these different Satipatthana suttas? Maybe the Buddha just taught Satipatthana differently in different times and different places. Yeah, maybe. Except they all seem to be supposed to be set in the same place and seem to be different versions of the same sutta. I think what's going on is that the actual details of the Satipatthana Sutta that we see in front of us were settled not by the Buddha, but by the schools, maybe 200 or 300, perhaps even 400 years after the Buddha. So that is to say, I think that the most or probably all of the actual words, the content of those suttas, probably stems from the Buddha. Yeah, but the actual way that it's organized and laid out, yeah, happened much later. So that's a bit disturbing, isn't it? Yeah? If we've been brought up to think that the Satipatthana Sutra is the most important sutra of the Buddha, and then we find out, shock horror, that maybe he didn't actually say it, we begin to wonder what exactly is going on. Now, you know, as I said before, we always need to keep re-emphasizing this, the main details of that Satipatthana are found the same in all of them. So, for example, they all talk about the 4 Satipatthanas, the body, feelings, yeah, so this is the 2nd Satipatthana, is contemplation of feelings, mind, citta, is the 3rd one, and dhammas is the 4th one. So all of those are the same. And the way that they're talked about is also quite similar. Like, they have this very famous phrase, one contemplates the body in the body, yeah? you may have heard that. And it's another one of these idioms which is a bit difficult to understand exactly what it means, but it seems to mean something like one focuses clearly on the body in and of itself. So you focus on the body as a body, you focus on the feelings, mind as mind, dhammas as dhammas. So these kind of this standard description of the practice also is very uniform, shared quite in common among all the different versions. And also the way, if we look at, say, the way the contemplation of feelings is described, is also very similar, hardly any difference, only if some minor difference. And the contemplation of mind also is very similar. But two that are different is the contemplation of bodies, the contemplation of dhammas, the first and the last of the four satipatthanas. So obviously I can't here go into discussing in detail all of these questions. There are very, very many issues to be discussed and little details to be sorted out. I've done as best as I can try to sort them out in a book which started out as an essay and ended up as a nearly 400-page book. So I can't go into all the details now. But maybe what I can do is to just summarize what are some of the conclusions of that from my perspective. Okay? I talked before about how satipatthana, it means meditation. Yeah? That focusing of the mindfulness, that bringing of attention in a very special and delicate way to a meditation object. And sustaining it there, keeping it there. Yeah? I think this is when we say contemplates a body in the body. Yeah? We have this word contemplates, so we translate it in English. Now, never forget that these are just, we say contemplate, what does it mean? That's an English translation of a Pali or Sanskrit word. Yeah? So forget what the English translation says. That's just a decision that a translator made. Yeah? What the Pali says is anupassi. Anu means along with. Yeah? Along with. Passi means to watch. Yeah? And anupassi means something like to... Like anu in a psychological context has an implication of continuing. Yeah? Going on and on. So you say vitakheti means to think. Anu vitakheti means to keep on thinking. Yeah? So here anupassati means to sustain one's observation. And that's also similar to the way, if you're familiar with the jhana factors, the jhana factor of vichara is described very similarly in the Abhidhamma. It says anupekhanata, like sustained observation, anusandhanata, sustained application. These are explanations given in the Pali Abhidhamma to this term vichara. Very similar to the idea of what anupassi means. So that's what I think anupassi means, is that sustained observation, watching. Just like we were doing when we were watching the breath just now. Yeah? You're bringing up, focusing our mind, bringing our attention to that, and sustaining the observation in that one place. Bringing the mind to that oneness. Now, as you practice the breath meditation, okay, now I'll use the breath meditation as an example because it's probably the one you're most familiar with and the most important, but we can say more or less the same things about all of those meditations in Satipatthana. They all work in generally similar ways, similar principles, although the details are different. Yeah. So with the breath meditation, we're watching in that one place, bringing the mind, focusing more and more on that breath. As we do that, we find that the breath becomes peaceful. Now you can see that that's like an interplay, yeah? Because we bring, the mind is sustained on the breath, so the mind's not so agitated, then the breath itself becomes more peaceful. Because the breath is becoming more peaceful, then the mind will become more peaceful. Yeah? And on and on and on it goes. It's like this dance that the mind and the meditation object's doing, just together becoming more and more peaceful. And so this is why we need to keep on in that early stage of meditation. Remember I was saying in the breath meditation, keep on lifting your mind onto the breath, yeah? Because the mind won't stick. Yeah? It will always be going out the place. So this lifting the mind on is like the jhana factor of vitaka, yeah? Applying the mind to the breath. keep on having to apply the mind because it's not yet stable. As you keep on doing that, gradually it will become more stable. Gradually it will start to come closer to the mind. It won't slip off so quickly. And as you do that, the breath will become more and more peaceful. And you'll be able to sustain your observation on the breath. What starts to happen then is, as the physical feeling of the breath becomes more subtle, it starts to get very, very refined. And it starts to, as it were, become transparent. It becomes so subtle that you can see through it. Yeah? And you see through that air, you see through the mere physical feeling of the breath into the feelings that underlie that. Yeah? And this vedana, or contemplation of feelings, can also be understood in this context as also including or being at least closely connected to the contemplation of perception, sanya. And we see the sanya, we see the perception as like a light. The feeling is like a happy feeling. So these are the two things that start to emerge at this point of meditation. When your breath has become very peaceful, you'll feel a pleasant feeling emerging with the breath, like through the breath. And that pleasant feeling is accompanied by a sensation of light. Yeah? As the hindrances are leaving the mind's becoming bright. And you see that. You actually see it with your mind's eye as like a light that starts to develop, starts to grow inside the mind. And this is where you're moving from contemplation of the body into contemplation of feelings. Okay? So, look, this is like a natural process, yeah? It's like a description of how meditation unfolds. It's not really like a meditation technique, which is telling you do this and then do that and then do that, yeah? It's more like a natural law than it is like a law of the land. So we use a description. We distinguish between a descriptive law and a prescriptive law. A prescriptive law is when the government says you can't drive faster than 60 kilometers an hour. Yeah, and that tries to control how people behave. Yeah, it's a law which tries to affect how people behave. A natural law doesn't work like that. A natural law describes how things happen anyway. So the law of gravity describes how things fall down. But it doesn't make things fall down. This is often we misunderstand. We naively think that the law of gravity makes objects fall down to the ground. There's no law, there's no policeman enforcing the law of gravity. Yeah? There's no courts that are going to fine things because they don't fall down properly. The law of gravity is just a description of how things behave. Yeah? So this is what Galileo and Newton and so on saw. They saw things behave in this way. And when they saw it, and then they could formulate a very precise description of that, which we call the law of gravity. Now in the same way, this satipatthana is not like as a meditation, it's a description of how the meditation practice is unfolding. So you're not necessarily consciously saying, well, now I've done body contemplation, so now I'm going to do feeling contemplation, yeah? But it's as it were, when that body contemplation is complete, when you really know, when you really fully see that body, you, as it were, you see through it. Yeah? You see through that body and you see the feelings that underlie that. And you realize, when you're doing this, you realize that this breath, what we call the breath, what we believe is just air, it's just gas coming in and out, it's actually a conscious experience. In our minds is a conscious experience of that breath. And as we see that subtle feeling of the breath come out, it appears to our mind like a light or like a blissful feeling. Yeah? This is how this experience of the breath appears to our mind. And so this is like the contemplation of feelings. We're starting to see what the Buddha called this niramisa sukha, spiritual bliss. Okay? So satipatthana, when we're contemplating the feelings, includes all feelings. So painful feelings, pleasant feelings, neutral feelings, worldly feelings, spiritual feelings, yeah, good feelings, bad feelings, whatever. Yeah? They're all included and they're all part of satipatthana. That means we can, it's all valid to contemplate those things. But the most important ones are these feelings of niramisa sukha, this spiritual bliss, this spiritual happiness. Now, as the mind experiences this happiness more and more and more, it helps to make the mind more content. You just want to stay in that one place. You want to stay still. And because you want to stay still, then you see the mind becomes gradually unified. It becomes one. And so again, you develop an understanding of these things through contrast. Yeah? So for example, you know what painful feelings are by contrast with pleasant feelings. And you know what a scattered mind is by contrast with a unified mind, a collected mind. Until you've known what that is, to have your mind collected and become one, then you won't know what the scattered mind is. Yeah? Until you know, it's like the fish who lives in the sea all their time, they just live in the ocean. They never know what water is. Yeah? Until they leave the ocean, then they know what water is. So in the same way, we don't understand what it means to have the mind scattered until we've seen what it means to have the mind concentrated in samadhi. So this is why this practice of satipatthana in the contemplation of mind includes both the scattered mind, the mind that's full of desires, the mind that's full of anger, the mind that's full of delusion, and also the mind that's free of these things, and the mind that's in samadhi, the mind that's in jhana, the mind that's exalted, that's measureless. So until we have both of those things, we haven't really done that contemplation of mind, we haven't completed it. Now finally we come to the contemplation of dhammas. Now again we can see this whole thing has been like an unfolding. Yeah? It's a gradual movement, a natural process of the mind in meditation. Contemplation of dhammas, what does that mean? Now again, the specific details of this practice that have been passed down in the various versions differ quite a lot. But consistently, what every version has, very consistently, is they have two particular practices. One is the contemplation of the five hindrances, and the second is the seven enlightenment factors. Yeah? And for various reasons, which I can't go into the details now, but I think it's extremely likely that in this case we can conclude that the original Satipatthana Sutta only had these two practices, the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. So the five hindrances are those things that obstruct samadhi. The seven enlightenment factors are those things that support samadhi, that support the mind. The way that these practices are phrased in this contemplation of dhammas is quite distinct from the way that earlier practices are phrased in Satipatthana, in the first three Satipatthanas. And specifically, in this fourth Satipatthana, contemplation of dhammas, it says one understands how the sensual desire comes to be and how it fades away. Previously it didn't say that. Previously it just says, for example, you know pleasant feeling is there, you know when it's absent. You know unpleasant feeling is there, you know it's absent. But it doesn't tell you to investigate further. It just tells you be aware of these things when they're there and when they're gone. Now, in the contemplation of dhammas, it says you understand how it comes to be, how it comes to be abandoned, how it comes to arise again in the future or to not arise again in the future. Yeah? So this is like you're understanding cause and effect. Yeah? Cause and effect in that realm of the mind, that realm of meditation. Why is my meditation going well today? Yeah? Why is it not going well? Why do those hindrances come into my mind? Yeah? Why are those hindrances sometimes there and sometimes not? Why was I angry? Yeah? Why was I confused? Why did I have lots of joy today? Where did that come from? What's the cause? This is how we're being taught to practice in that contemplation of dhammas. So, you remember when we did the breath meditation before, I asked you just very briefly at the end to reflect back over your meditation. Yeah? So this, in a very simple way, is what this contemplation of dhammas is about. To be able to reflect over your meditation and understand how it works. So for the first three satipatthanas, it's as if we're in the meditation. We're part of it. And now we're kind of stepping back a little bit and we're asking how it works. It's a little bit like, you can think of, like, say, you're watching a movie, And when you watch it, you get drawn into it. You identify with the characters. When they laugh, you laugh. When they cry, you cry. Yeah? You're drawn in there. Yeah? And then later on, afterwards, somebody says, so how was that movie? You know, was the acting good? Yeah? What was the cinematography like? And then you can reflect on the movie and analyze it. Oh, this is why they made me cry at that point. This is how they made me laugh at that point. Yeah? You understand the movie. And to do that, you have to step back from it a little bit. So this is something like that process of meditation that's being taught here. If you can do that, that leads to two very important results. One important result is that because you understand your meditation, it'll be reliable. It's not hit and miss anymore. You understand, why is the mind peaceful, why is it not? So you can make it reliable, make it peaceful every time. So that's one good benefit of that practice. The second one is, of course, that you're understanding impermanence. You're understanding causality. And this is leading to wisdom. You're understanding the mind. This is leading to vipassana. So this is how the vipassana side of satipatthana emerges from the samatha side. The insight emerges from the calmness in the mind, yeah, and the stillness of the mind. And when those things are mature and when they're in balance, and then of course they will lead ultimately to the experience of enlightenment, the experience of nibbana. So this is my little talk for this evening on satipatthana, the way to unification. Maybe a bit different from some other teachings on satipatthana you've ever heard, but as I commented last night, I try to say all the things that other monks don't say. Yeah? So there's no point in me coming all the way here from Australia just to say the same thing that everybody else is already saying already, so I might as well say something different. So I'd like to open up now. Remember that we have to be out here before 10. So I'd like to open up for some questions or comments.